Hearing to order, last meeting we recessed and we called the chair, the chair just called it, and I turned the gavel over to my co-chairman. We're, oh, by the way, we're gonna get, drop the, not gonna be hearing House Bill 406 at this time, and now we're proceeding to the Mr. Co-chairman.
Thank you,
No,
we're gonna do it now. it is, 1:15. We do have a quorum. Present today, for the record, is Representative Dyson, Green, Barnes, Williams, co-chair Ogun, and myself, co-chair Bill Hudson. I got Williams, yes, I got him. We said Bill Square, but what I'm going to do today is I'm going to take House Joint Resolution Number 52. This is the opposing the American Heritage Rivers. There are very little testimony apparently that is indicated on that. We have one online from Fairbanks, Mr. Lippart, and we do have the prime sponsor, Representative Jeanette James, with us today. I take this up. My idea here is to try to take the two resolutions in pretty rapid fire order if we can. So that we can get down to the bill of substance, which is House Bill 28, repeal the Coastal Zone Management Program. We have a lot of people want to testify on that, and we have people here that will testify. So with that, Representative James, welcome to the committee. If you would care to present your resolution, we'd be happy to receive it.
Representative Hudson, this is Representative Nikolai Fairbanks.
Thank you, Representative. Will you be on the line with us and stay on the line?
Yeah, I'll be here for a little bit.
All right, fine. Well, then the record will show that that you are officially on board with us, and also you've now been joined by Representative Jewell. So we clearly have a quorum. And Representative James, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. HJR 52 is relating to opposition to the designation of any rivers in Alaska as American Heritage Rivers under the American Heritage Rivers Initiative. Many of you will be wondering, what is the American Heritage River Initiative? It has not been a widely publicized program. President Clinton first announced it on February 4th in 1997 in a State of the Union message. And then in May and September, there were announcements in the Federal Register. Since his State of the Union message, President Clinton issued Executive Order 13061 directing agencies to establish and implement the initiative. The program has two objectives. One is to enhance our citizens' enjoyment of the historic, cultural, recreational, economic, and environmental value of our rivers, and two, to protect the health of our communities by delivering federal resources more efficiently and effectively. The President's purpose is to support communities within existing laws and regulations by providing them with better information, tools and resources, and encouraging local efforts deserving of special recognition. We wonder. It all sounds very good and quite innocent, just like so many federal acts and initiatives in the past. They all seem innocent and even beneficial until they begin touching the lives and rights of real people. For instance, it was a false promise when people were told there is a self-defense provision in the Endangered Species Act. John Schuler of Montana killed grizzly bear after it attacked him late one night. Federal officials rendered the self-defense provision a nullity, saying that Mr. Schuler was at fault for going into the zone of imminent danger. That zone happened to be his own backyard. It was another false promise when they adopted wilderness legislation saying that there was a provision for the protection of valid existing rights. The promise was that no private land would be taken into wilderness areas without the consent of the owner, and that only federal land would become wilderness, and that no buffer zones would be created. Not so, according to Kathy Stupik-Thrall of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Kathy Stupik-Thrall has been compelled to fight government attorneys who say the provisions have no meaning or they do not apply to her private property and her valid existing rights. These lawyers say that Congress didn't know what the language of the phrase valid existing rights meant. Therefore, they can interpret it any way they wish. I would say there's good reason for the distress throughout our country regarding the President's American Rivers proposal, particularly with an attitude like that driving government attorneys. The American people are not stupid. They are well aware that a legacy of betrayals and broken promises are attached to these types of well-intentioned, pleasant-sounding, feel-good programs. For this reason, many states are joining with U.S. Representative Helen Chenoweth of Idaho, who has introduced legislation asking for the complete withdrawal of the initiative. There are three major areas of concern. One, the lack of congressional approval. Two, the vague language and absence of definitions, and the excess federal control over private property and state water rights. As a sovereign state, it also conflicts with our rights to control and manage our own navigable waters. One important point is that Congress should be making rules and regulations respecting federal lands and resources, not the president or his appointees. We are again faced with a president stepping beyond the boundaries of his office. As Chenoweth stated in a press release after the House Resource Committee meeting, we are doing things exactly backwards here today. Instead of Congress making the proposal and the administration commenting on it, we are actually in a position today of taking testimony not on the creation of a new program, but on how to stop it. In addition, there's no justification of the need for such an initiative, and the details of the initiative are insufficient. It does not include any details on how the cleanup will be accomplished, what will actually be done, and who will do the work. Allowing more time for the public process is another concern. As it is, there has not been sufficient time for reviews and comments by the public on the initiative. Some people believe it is another intrusion of the federal government and a way to get control of all of our lands. To protect our sovereignty, this initiative must be stopped. I urge you to vote yes on this legislation. The two rivers, actually, that are that I've heard about that are being focused on here within the state is the Chena River in the Tanana Valley and the Kenai River. And it doesn't affect just the river itself. It's the entire drainage of the river. So it would be covered by lots of private property and other property interests that would be affected by this national designation. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I have a huge packet for you with a lot of information. There's just one thing I would like to read out of to you out of the Heritage Foundation's FYI, which is labeled Good Politics, Bad Policy, Clinton's American Heritage River Initiative. And a few pages in, it says, if President Clinton wants to see his initiative implemented properly, then he first should propose legislation to Congress and allow Congress to approve or reject the initiative based on the merits of the proposal and the will of the people. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative James. Just for the record, we were joined shortly after we started up here with Vice Chair Massett. I think effectively gives us everybody here, even though I've already got Reggie when he came in. So we got everybody officially on the record here, with Irene Nikolai on the air from Fairbanks. Everybody on the committee is here, and I appreciate that. I think my co-chair had.
Mr. Chairman, two things. First, so we have this resolution before us, may I make a motion to adopt the bill that is before us?
You may do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Resources Committee adopt House Joint Resolution number 52 as the bill before us for testimony.
Any objections? Hearing none, so adopted.
And the second part of what I had to say is, for the information of the people that are here, and I know that Representative James was contacted during the interim when there was an attempt made to turn the Kenai River into American Heritage River, and there was a tremendous outpour of opposition, and the assembly down there finally defeated that proposal, and it was not, and it did not go forward.
Thank you, Representative Barnes. My co-chair, Ogun.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had the opportunity earlier this year, that was last year, after session, last summer, to attend a Western States Coalition meeting, which and had the opportunity to listen to Katie McGinty, who's Kathleen McGinty, I guess her name is, who basically, from what I've been told, is the policy advisor on the president's staff on environmental issues. And Ms. McGinty did state that if state or an area did not want to be included, that they would listen to those accommodations. It was a fascinating presentation. I have to admire her for going into the den of wolves, as it was. I mean, those that were, was anybody else at that? Representative Green was, and she was. It was definitely a hostile crowd. But I'd just like to point out that in 1953, the Submerged Land Act was a reaffirmation of Congress of title in the state to lands beneath navigable waters. And the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled in various case law. It says that the act also affirms the right and power of states to manage, administer, lease, develop, and use said lands and natural resources in all accordance with applicable state law. I believe that this this proposal that the American Heritage Rivers is an undermining of our state sovereignty, and I will certainly support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. We do have three people on the legislative teleconference network system and one off-net. That's Ms. Kathleen Benedetto, I believe. And I think, Kathleen, if you can hear me, we'd take your testimony first.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kathleen Benedetto. I'm the Executive Director of the Minerals Exploration Coalition, a nonprofit advocacy group for the multiple use of public lands. Specifically, MEC works to maintain access for mineral entry on these lands. Our membership, including 30 corporations, represents a diverse group of professionals and companies engaged in mineral exploration and development. I have more than 20 years of experience in the minerals industry as an exploration geologist and activist. In 1993, I started co-founded the Women's Mining Coalition to work on responsible mining law reform. I've worked closely with the Western States Coalition, the Alliance for America, and other grassroots organizations. The common thread for these groups is a commitment to improving and modernizing national environmental policy by promoting a strong conservation ethic that recognizes our most important resource, people, as part of the environment. Today, I am pleased to testify before your legislature in support of your resolution opposing designation of any rivers in Alaska as American Heritage Rivers under the American Heritage Rivers Initiative, established by President Clinton through Executive Order 13061. MEC believes that if a river is designated as an American Heritage River, the designation will be used to restrict mineral access to public lands within the watershed. Each new land use program presented by the administration further restricts access to public and private lands for mineral development, grazing, timber harvest, and motorized recreation. These restrictions are established under the auspices of saving the environment without regard for the impact that they will have on people. In some cases, the restrictions do not provide any environmental benefit and may actually contribute to degradation of the environment and wildlife populations and habitats. The continued ability to discover and harvest the rich mineral resources of this country is critical. Mineral and other natural resources are the source of new money and the raw materials needed in manufacturing. Each American requires more than 40,000 pounds of mine materials annually. These mine materials are necessary to provide a clean, healthy environment for society. For example, gold is an important component in all electronic equipment, including telephones, computers, and satellite technology. Gold filaments allow us to reach out and touch our family, friends, and neighbors, and even those folks with whom we may not see eye to eye. It is used to trigger the deployment of airbags and in the protective clothing used by firefighters. Mineral and other natural resources are plentiful throughout the United States and the rest of the world. Access to and distribution of these resources are where many problems arise. On occasion, such problems are the result or result from formidable terrain or lack of infrastructure. However, in most situations, these problems are artificial and have been created by political decisions. The demand for natural resources will not decrease. Unchecked political decisions restricting access to resources will go beyond negatively impacting rural communities and public land states to impacting urban areas and the world community as a whole. I applaud the efforts of the Alaska Legislature and encourage them to pursue passage of House Joint Resolution Number 52, opposing designation of any river in Alaska as American Heritage River under the American Heritage River Initiative. Alex Annette with the Heritage Foundation in Good Politics, Bad Policy, Clinton's American Heritage Rivers Initiative, identified the five most serious problems with the initiative. One, it violates a number of constitutional and statutory provisions. Two, it is wasteful and inefficient. Three, it reduces the role and the authority of states. Four, it threatens property rights. And five, it serves political purposes. It is my observation that when the Clinton administration has been unsuccessful with a legislative initiative, they choose to circumvent Congress and the democratic process by issuing an executive order. This has been most apparent in their environmental and land use policies. The American Heritage Rivers Initiative is a good example. During the 104th session of Congress, a serious effort was made to pass the Omnibus American Heritage Areas Bill. However, as a result of the UNESCO designation of Yellowstone as a World Heritage Site in danger and the concerns raised by private property organizations throughout the country, the American Heritage Areas Bill did not pass. In response, during the 1997 State of the Union address, President Clinton announced the American Heritage Rivers Initiative. The initiative is a watered-down version of the American Heritage Areas Bill. To the uninitiated, the program appears to be rather benign and has often been described as a pork barrel project, just an opportunity to bring in some federal funds. Even if this were the case, the whole concept flies in the face of efforts to reduce the size of government. It is a giant step backwards. American Heritage Rivers Initiative expands federal bureaucracy, increases centrally planned conservation through punitive regulation, and does not encourage locally driven incentive-based conservation efforts. Finally, I call your attention to the list of executive orders and initiatives used by the administration that are affecting resource and recreation-based communities, rural school districts, and specific industries or companies. Logging in the Tongass National Forest, the 20-year moratorium on mineral entry in the New World Mining District and the Sweetgrass Hills, denial of access to coal reserves in Montana, no oil and gas drilling in Anwar, designation of the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, severely restricted drilling in the Lewis and Clark and Helena Deer Lodge National Forest, the American Heritage Rivers Initiative, signing of the Global Warming Protocol, Al Gore's Clean Water Initiative, the administrative rewrite of the BLM 3809 regulations governing hard rock mining, and most recently, the emergency moratorium of timber harvest within roadless areas. I encourage Alaska to sign the resolution opposing the American Heritage Rivers Initiative, House Joint Resolution Number 52. Congress needs support to stop the administration from usurping their constitutionally delegated responsibilities. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Benedetto. Next, I'd like to, I think we have quite a number of our good friends from Ketchikan that are here, and I do have one, Dick Coos. Did you wish to testify on 52? Would you join us, please? And then following Mr. Coos, I'll be going to Fairbanks next, Stan Lepart, if you would. Stand by on right after we get done here. We'll take your testimony. Dick, we'd be happy to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just real briefly, I represent the Ketchikan Gateway Borough as an assembly person, and we support your House Joint Resolution 52. We think that Representative James has very well described what will happen to Alaska, and we urge you to pass it.
Thank you very much. Next, we'll go to Fairbanks. San Lippard, is that correct?
Lippard, Mr. Chairman, thanks very much. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Stan Lippard. I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas, and I'd like to take just a few minutes today to share with the committee our commission's concerns about the American Heritage Rivers Initiative. I provided committee staff with a copy of the commission's comments that we submitted to Katie McGinty, the chair of the Council on Environmental Quality, last summer. In those comments, our commission joined many other organizations and individuals in urging that the proposed initiative not be adopted. Of course, as you all know, the president signed the executive order in September, and the initiative is now in place. Our analysis of the initiative indicated that, at best, it was poorly defined and a duplication of existing programs designed to provide assistance to local governments. At worst, it represented an entire new federal program conceived without statutory authority and which was a threat to state and local government authorities and the rights of private property owners. While there have been some improvements since the initiative was first proposed, many of the problems still remain. One of the stated goals of the initiative is to improve the delivery of services by the 12 departments and agencies on the American Heritage Rivers Interagency Committee. The obvious question which must be asked is, why does it take the creation of a new federal program and the designation of a river area to compel these 12 agencies to do their job? I think the obvious answer is that it does not. If a department or agency is not currently performing as it should, we fail to see how this initiative will change that. On the contrary, by requiring agencies to focus on this new program, they will have fewer resources available for more important programs. But better agency performance is not what this initiative is really all about. What the American Heritage River Initiative really represents is an effort to create, by executive fiat, a program that Congress refused to create when, in 1986, it rejected a number of bills which would have created a National Heritage Area Partnership Program. The objectives of that program are strikingly similar to those stated for this initiative. Our commission is also highly skeptical of the claims that designation of a river would occur only if there is, quote, broad community support, particularly in light of the extremely loose definition of the term community. The current federal administration has justified our skepticism through such actions as the creation of the 1.7 million acre Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument over the objections of not only local communities, but of state and local governments and the state of Utah's congressional delegation. It is not difficult to imagine similar actions occurring under this initiative. Another specious claim made by Ms. McGinty and the CEQ is that designation of a river will not result in imposition of additional federal regulations. While this may be true in a strict legal sense, designation of a river would require adherence to an entire array of program guidelines and requirements in order to maintain the designation and to qualify for federal funds. This would not come without some cost to local control or loss of opportunities for private property owners. It's a bit of a cliche, but there truly is no such thing as a free lunch, particularly when it comes to federal programs involving federal funds. One of the other issues that is related and I think really emphasizes the need to oppose this American Heritage Rivers Initiative is the fact that currently we have 26 rivers in the state of Alaska that are designated as wild, scenic, or recreational under the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. Action was taken in the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. In addition, the U.S. Forest Service and its recently revised Congress Land Management Plan has identified, I believe, another 20-something rivers that they are recommending for designation as wild and scenic river segments. The U.S. Forest Service is also in the process of revising the Chugach National Forest Plan. Again, they have identified some 20-odd rivers for possible designation as wild and scenic rivers. Over the next few years, other federal agencies will be revising management plans for the areas under their control. Part of that revision process will involve studying and identifying and making recommendations for possible additions to the wild and scenic river system. One of the problems related to that is that once an agency recommends designation of a river segment, it is required to manage that river in such a fashion so that its future potential to be designated by Congress is not jeopardized. In other words, they manage that river as if it were already designated. I would submit, Mr. Chairman, that what we don't need in this state is another program that would place additional federal controls over Alaska's river systems. We will be watching this American Heritage Rivers Initiative very closely in the months to come. There are some 126 river segments in the country that have been nominated by various individuals and entities. My understanding is that the President will make his decision sometime by mid-March or mid-April for designation of some 10 of those rivers. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on HCR 52.
Thank you, Mr. Liebhardt. Next, I'm going to go to Anchorage, where I have Todd Owens. And Todd, we do have your letter of support in the packet. So if I could ask you if you would simply provide us with hopefully a very abbreviated anything that you feel might need to be supplement your letter.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to comment on House Joint Resolution 52 relating to the American Heritage Rivers Initiative. As many of you know, RDC is a membership-funded organization which advocates for Alaska's basic industry sectors. RDC strongly supports HCR 52, opposing the designation of any Alaskan rivers as American Heritage Rivers. RDC finds three aspects of the Rivers Initiative particularly troubling. First, the initiative is a threat to private property owners throughout the United States. Currently, no safeguards exist to protect the rights of private property owners. Second, no clear justification for such a program has been provided. Without a clearly defined purpose, the Rivers Initiative threatens to add to the already cumbersome complex of federal land management policies in Alaska. RDC fears the additional layer of regulations used to manage the American Heritage Rivers will act as yet another roadblock to development projects and recreation activities in Alaska. Finally, there's no legal authority nor practical need for additional lands in Alaska to be placed under federal land management. The American Heritage Rivers Initiative is an unnecessary federal program likely to create conflict between state and local communities and the federal government. HGR 52 is an appropriate step forward in addressing the Rivers Initiative, and RDC urges its passage. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you for your testimony. In Kenai, Leonard Efta, and if I could, Leonard, if you would try to be as brief as possible, we have several other pieces we want to try to get to today.
Thank you. This is Leonard Efta, Kenai, and I'd like to thank Representative Barnes and James Ryder and the co-sponsor Barnes for introducing this resolution. I question, and I definitely support it. My big question is, by what authority does the President have to issue legislation and also to for legislation as far as the funds to support this? I find it no place in the Constitution that I've read. Maybe I'm getting the wrong one. But also, it's pretty obvious from past experience with the federal government, whenever there's a dime involved, they will have strings attached to it. So I strongly support this resolution, and again, thank you for the opportunity to testify.
And thank you very much, Mr. Efta. That concludes the testimony of people who have signed up to testify on House Joint Resolution number 52. I would, if there's anybody in the audience that failed to sign up here that wants to testify, I would take that at the time. Nobody? All right. Our chair will entertain a motion, Representative Barnes.
Chairman, I move that House Joint Resolution number 52 be reported out of the committee with individual recommendations and any zero fiscal note that's attached.
Ask unanimous consent. Any objection? Resolution moved out of committee. Next, we will take up House Joint Resolution number 56. And I am the prime sponsor, although I must say I probably should have given that to Representative Williams, since it's really in his backyard. You will notice that he is the first name behind us there, and very supportive of this as well. But if I might prevail upon the committee for, as the chairman, to go ahead and introduce this resolution as well. House Joint Resolution number 56 urges the Federal Railroad Administration to transfer the Linear Induction Motor Research Vehicle, kind of a mouthful here, to the state of Alaska, or to the state for actual putting it into test and research in the state of Alaska. The transfer will allow for potential development of a new industrial and research business in Alaska. The development of yttrium, that's the correct pronunciation, a rare earth element, could revitalize the Ketchikan area after the loss of the pulp mill. The yttrium will be mined on Prince of Wales Island and processed in Ketchikan. At the present time, I think yttrium is all imported, literally from overseas. And that field was originally, and I understand now, may not be in the picture for the final high-speed test site. If it is not, Ketchikan most certainly will be. That's what we hear from the people in Ketchikan. Local employment in the mining and refining, as well as converting this this vehicle, would be used by Power Superconductors Applications Corporation. They've called upon us, and I think are here today. There is no state funding requested for this new industrial development. This is the jobs program that we don't have to put money into. The transfer of the vehicle could provide an opportunity for economic growth and development. And there's a whole lot of information in the resolution itself, which is really quite fascinating and interesting. The applications, and I think some folks are here to speak to that, are pretty fascinating, and I'll let them talk essentially to that as well. So with that in mind, I would ask, maybe in reverse, let's see, John Pearson. John, would you like to join us here, please? And then we'll follow with Dick Coos.
Do you want a motion to put
yes,
it before?
Yes, please, if you would. Thank you, Representative Barnes.
Mr. Chairman, I move that House Joint Resolution number 56 be before the committee for purposes of testimony.
Is there any objection? Then House Joint Resolution number 56 is officially before us for testimony and action. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is John Pearson. I live here in Juneau and have a small company called Alaska Economic Development Partnerships. During the past 22 years, I've been involved in fostering many Alaska economic development efforts, both as a former employee of the state of Alaska, Department of Commerce, and now as a practitioner and advocate for orderly economic development. The opportunity placed before us in this form of a cooperative partnership between the city of Ketchikan, Saxman, the state of Alaska, and the federal government is very unique and offers a number of opportunities that we never thought would exist just a few months ago. During the past 5 months, I've been a part of the discussion that has centered around this futuristic industry. My colleague, Bill Pollack, is more into the engineering side of things and the technical, and he can tell you a lot more than I can on that. But it comes down to the major areas being mining, refining, manufacturing, research. The first of that would take place as soon as the vehicle is transferred from the federal government to Alaska. And that work would involve retrofitting this vehicle into a research vehicle. I think in your packet you have photos of it that shows what the vehicle looks like. I'm sure that Representative Williams would agree the only thing, it needs some windshield wipers on the front of it, and it would be in good hands there in Ketchikan. In my opinion, we are very fortunate to have had Dr. Stephen Kuznetsov step forward, knock on the door of the state, knock on the door of these communities, and offered to bring parts of his industry and his expertise into the region. This will no doubt give us a strong base in southern southeast into well into the 21st century. It would provide a number of jobs, the types of jobs that we've not had in the past. At the same time, I think it's important to note that just as here in Juneau, when the Greens Creek mine started up, there were a number of training opportunities that was put into place by the university. And I see educational and training to be very much part of new offerings at the Ketchikan campus. At the present time, the plan would be transfer the vehicle. It would come to Ketchikan, Saxman. It would then be retrofitted under the technical supervision of the people from Power Superconductor. The support of the Alaska legislature in urging the federal government to transfer this vehicle will be important to all of us. And I would urge you to support this resolution and to ask the support of your colleagues. I'd like to say thanks for this opportunity, and I think Bill Pollock will be able to give you some of the technical things, which is really out there quite a ways for some of us. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Next, I'd like to take Dr. Kuznetsov. I understand that you're on the line.
Yes, I am here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Doctor, if you could go ahead and give us your testimony for the record, first of all, your name and your association, please.
My name is Stephen Kuznetsov. I am president and chairman of Power Superconductor Applications Corporation, based in Newcastle, Pennsylvania.
Go ahead, sir, if you testify on this, and we'd appreciate it.
Thank you. a few items that are important here are to understand the basis of the technological development. Our company has been involved since 1986 in the design and manufacture of high-speed linear induction machines. These are propulsion machines. They are used for launching aircraft in some cases. They are also used in the transit industry. I was fortunate enough in my career, starting 1974, to be a design engineer on the linear induction motor vehicle. And we obtained the world ground speed record in the 1970s of 255 miles an hour with this vehicle using a copper and steel-based propulsion system. It does not rely on the adhesion of steel wheel to a steel rail. It relies on electromagnetic propulsion. And what has happened just within the last 3 years, this is a development of the U.S. government at Los Alamos National Laboratory. We have learned as a country now, with the help of the scientists at Los Alamos, how to produce a yttrium-based superconductor. And the United States government owns a number of the patent rights in this area. Our company owns a number of the patent rights on the final application technology. But starting in 1997, Los Alamos now has produced yttrium-based superconductors to be used for electric utility apparatus, such as fault limiters and transmission lines. We have built several prototype motors and generators using the high-temperature superconductor, and in essence, building technologies that can allow the electricity to operate at 99% efficiency. So this is a very cutting-edge technology. U.S. government spending a small fortune on the technologies right now for the electric power system. But the significance of the LIMRV, as we see it, is this will allow U.S. industry to develop propulsion systems as to eventually use the yttrium-type superconductor. And a part of the project here is obviously to set up a manufacturing facility and a research development facility in Alaska in the southeast that would rely on the yttrium-based superconductor to produce products such as fault limiters and superconducting propulsion systems. So the House Joint Resolution 56 addresses two aspects of the project. We strongly believe that the LIMRV, which has been in storage now for 20 years, is a very significant development. Our company is looking to siting a small manufacturing plant in the area as well as retrofit this vehicle. As the eventual business that we see developing out of this is to commercially manufacture advanced linear induction braking systems for the railroad industry, and then also to produce linear induction machines for the Navy catapult. That concludes my testimony. If there are any questions, I'd be pleased to take them. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Kudnetsov. I will now go here in Juneau to Dick Kuss again, please, from Ketchikan Borough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Dick Kuss. I represent the Ketchikan Gateway Borough as an assembly person, and the borough fully supports this resolution. We think there's a great opportunity here for us to develop a new business in town, and the release of this induction motor research vehicle to Alaska is the first step in that. So we urge your passage of this resolution.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kuss. Next, Bob Weinstein, also from Ketchikan. Welcome, Mr. Mayor.
Well, thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Bob Weinstein. I'm the mayor of the city of Ketchikan. And very briefly, like the predecessor speakers, I would like to urge your support of this resolution. As you know, with the closure of our major employer in Ketchikan last year, we are aggressively, we being the city, borough, and virtually all of our citizens, aggressively and diligently looking for economic opportunities with which we can diversify our economy. This represents some potential in that area, something that we, again, being the city and borough, will be working together with Dr. Kuznetsov's corporation to see how this project might translate into some mining, manufacturing, and scientific research jobs in Ketchikan. We think it will be of benefit not only to our community, but to the entire state of Alaska. And while this resolution may seem like a small step, it's a very important step, apparently, to get the research vehicle transferred to state ownership. My understanding is that the congressional delegation, Governor Knowles, and others have written letters to the Federal Railroad Agency in support of this. And again, I would urge your support and of this particular resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Are there any questions?
Thank you.
Hearing none, that does terminate those who have signed up to
can I do it now?
Representative Barnes.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move the House Joint Resolution number 56 be reported from the committee with individual recommendations and any zero fiscal notes attached.
I ask
unanimous consent.
Any objection? This resolution, like the last one, flies out of this committee. Now we'll take up the fun one. And here on House Bill 28, let's see, do we have the prime sponsor here? Yes, we do. Terry, would you like to join us at the table to begin with? And let me just kind of set the stage here. We do have a number of people on the net that have asked to testify on this House bill. It's a very, very important piece of legislation, and obviously there's a lot of questions, and we need to try to resolve as many of those as possible. What I'm going to do, for the interest of those who are on the network, I'm going to kind of be skipping around the various locations, and I would like to try to get, and you can kind of develop that for yourself, if you would please, at the site, whoever you believe is there that is more directly related to the program, so that we can get a direct reference as to the application in your local region, and that we'll try to get a sampling from around the various sites, and then I'll go back in and try to pick up the balance of them. That way maybe we can get on through this. But I'd like to start out first by welcoming the prime sponsor,
Representative Terrio, and he will introduce his staff. And before I do anything further, Representative Barnes, I need to adopt this committee substitute. I believe I have to adopt this one. Yes, I have to adopt the...
Didn't I make that motion the other day?
No, I think all we did was adopt an amendment, but now we have to...
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt the CS for House Bill 28 Resources as amended.
Is there any objection to the adoption of the committee substitute as amended?
We did adopt it. Because I made the motion.
It's twice adopted, but
that's
it must
good.
Be twice as strong.
Right.
That's backslash B, Mr. Chairman.
Sorry?
That's backslash B. Just so that I got
the... Yeah, slash B.
Okay. Yes. All right. I'm sorry. I thought the record indicated that we had that.
Just in case, take the roll. That way we will.
Is there any objection to the adoption? Hearing none, this bill is properly before us, if it wasn't before.
Along with the amendment adopted.
Along with the amendment adopted, as amended. And with that, Representative Terrio, now, sir, if you would kind of set the stage for us here a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the committee's work not only last year, but last week when I was before you just to introduce the proposed CS. I think a couple of things that I just want to touch on briefly so that you can get to the local testimony in the teleconference is that when the bill was before you last year, of course, the language was an outright repeal of the program. The things that we heard from people that testified last year were primarily that they were afraid of what the impact would be with not having the program and the loss of the federal funds that come along with the program. Under the CS, those federal funds, I believe, are retained. Another thing that we heard about last year is the desire to retain a coordination function between multi-permit proposals, and I believe under the CS, that coordination function through DGC is retained. We also heard that the local governments and local individuals needed to have a seat at the table with not only with regards to state permitted projects, but federally permitted projects. And all, again, I believe under the CS, that local right of input is retained. Some of the other things, though, I am hoping to also retain, though, are some of the streamlining and efficiency that I spoke of last year when I testified. If you do remember, I indicated that I became interested in this section of statutes and introduced House Bill 28 after dealing with agencies' budgets upstairs in finance and speaking to them on how we could help with the very tight dollars that we have to allocate for state functions these days. I think we... Or tightening up of the coastal zone language from three separate zones, restricting it down to two. That would impact, it's my understanding, 11 of the 30 or 35 of coastal districts. But I think if you go back to the where the initial program was implemented into law, the federal verbiage the state had to consider at the time, my staff has done some research back to the documents that were considered back in 1976. And I think it's interesting to point out that the federal government's own verbiage indicated that, and this is a quote, the landward extent of the coastal zone is to be determined by the state subject to statutory limitations. However, it is clear that the intent of Congress was that states delineate boundaries with a relatively conservative approach, including only those shorelands, the use of which have a direct and significant impact on the coastal states. And I think that by restricting the coastal zone as we've proposed in the CF, we still will meet that standard. I think DGC's own information shows that at the time, the state had to make an argued fairly strenuously with the federal government why we should go beyond that that very conservative wording. And I don't think now dropping back to a more conservative approach would cause us any real significant problem with continued federal recognition of our program. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to see if my staff has anything that I haven't touched on before we get to the public comment.
Thank you very much, Representative. Sarah, do you have anything you'd like to add to the opening testimony? If you would, for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Sarah Fisher-Goad, staff to Representative Terrio. I think Representative Terrio, hit the highlights of the proposed CS. I really don't have anything to add on that testimony. I think I'm here to answer some questions if there are some.
Thank you. Representative Williams, you have a question, sir, or a comment?
Thank you. I have a question for the sponsor. I'm glad you did break it down a little bit here, and it does affect the coastal communities. And also, have you been working with the department on this, and how so, or the administration?
We've been going back and forth with Division of Governmental Coordination. I've had numerous conversations with staff out of the governor's office. I think it's fair to characterize that we look at this from different perspectives, but there has been a lot of communication back and forth.
Mr. Chairman
Williams?
Yes. We have some testimony from United Fishermen of Alaska opposing the bill and their concerns about the watershed. How would you address that?
Well, I think what we need to remember is when this program went into place, it was sort of supposed to be a bridge over statutory gaps of where there was gaps in our environmental protection. That was back in the mid-70s. Since that time, numerous federal and state agency permit requirements have come into being that offer additional protection. It didn't exist at that time. We have the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. We have Title 46 Fish and Game Regulations, Forest Practices Act. A number of things in our own state government have grown up, independent permitting requirements that I think have largely, I believe, have eliminated those gaps, and those statutory permit requirements actually offer some overlap of their own at this point. I still think, though, that we do need to have some overall coordination function to make sure that applicants that require multiple permits are not tied up, you know, going through the motions with each agency, Fish and Game, DEC, DNR, independently, but we do retain that overall coordination function. I think that is real valuable. That is somewhat separate, though, than the Coastal Zone program, but the two are sort of linked together. So I think what you're likely to hear today, I hope people sort of speak on specifics. I think it's human nature to resist and be suspicious of any change in the status quo. We're no longer proposing a deletion of the program, but we are proposing some changes to the status quo. People are comfortable and sort of know how things work, and I think we are confronted with that on a daily basis in considering legislation that people are resistant to that change. And I hope the comments today reflect the changes that we've made in bringing the CS forward and are not just a restatement of some of the overall concerns that were expressed last year.
Representative, would you have follow-up, sir?
Yes. So what you're saying then with all these other programs in effect, the Forest Practices Act, will take care of the fish strains and the sort. And we also mentioned something about the having the having this in place, we would be able to we wouldn't lose that coordination of having to go through all of the other going through all of the other departments, and we can just deal with the Coastal Zone Management Division, and they would take care of all of the issues or what the city of Sitka is concerned about. You're saying that the city of Sitka shouldn't have to worry about losing that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, with the adoption, if the committee adopts the CS, that coordination is retained, access to the federal funds is retained, the right of the local people to make comment and have a determination of consistency with their local coastal plan is retained. So I think that the true things that people see as positives from the program are retained by the CS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Jewell, you had a question, sir?
Yep. There's some of the areas that have come up with their management plans have done it over considerable time and probably expense. And as these, have to change in terms of boundaries, are you also going to propose that the money follow in terms so that people can make these changes? Or is this going to be at the expense of those coastal communities that are affected by this?
Mr. Chairman, although I think the comments from DGC are that the maps are somewhat dated, I don't know that the geography and topography of the coastal areas changed much. And I think when those initial zones were identified, all we're asking is that for those 11 districts that included that third zone, that portion be dropped off. I'm not sure that there will be a lot of actual out-of-pocket expense that would have to go along with that. It hasn't been shown to my satisfaction that financial concern is real legitimate. I do know, or I could pledge to you that when we look at the fiscal notes upstairs in finance, that would be something that we would certainly try to address.
Thank you very much. Thank you. If there's no other questions from the committee, I would ask next that we hear from Diane Mayer. And Diane, so that you know what my intentions are, I believe issues like this are really important for us to try to understand, and I would like to have you go ahead and walk us through your perception of the bill. And then if you wouldn't mind, I might ask either the sponsor or his representative to join you at the table. I truly appreciate that kind of give and take in behalf of the committee so that we can ask a question and perhaps get two different, hopefully accurate answers. So please, for the committee, if you would give us your name and age, serial number. No, I'm only kidding.
If I could step at my name. My name is Diane Mayer, and I'm the director of Division of Governmental Coordination. One of the primary duties of our division is to oversee the Coastal Zone Management Act, Elastic Coastal Zone Management Act. The committee substitute that is before you as of last Thursday has very substantive effects on our program and has administrative repercussions that will run out for several years. And I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk to the committee about what that means and put the bill in perspective. And I like your idea, Mr. Chairman, that we might have some discussion here at the table in front of the committee to really get into some of the give and take. And I think that would be a unique opportunity for us as well as the committee to get a read on the bill. I am concerned, and I don't know what the protocol is, but this bill was to be heard last Thursday. And I know that there were many people online and in communities all over Alaska that wanted to testify, and I'm personally concerned if we get into that immediately that it would be another day where these people might miss the opportunity. And if the committee has the flexibility, I'm available anytime here in town to do this. And if it's possible that we might hear testimony from the people who are in their second day of wanting to testify first, if that would please the committee to do it so they can get back to their jobs. It's a courtesy to them, and if it doesn't work for you, I really don't know the protocol, and I'll go with whatever you say.
And I think it's a excellent suggestion. I do intend to get as soon as I can to the line. Let me tell you what I want to do. Is I'd like to have you frame what you consider to be the principal concerns with the revised bill, just so the committee has an understanding of where are the problem areas, what are we losing, and then perhaps Representative Terrio or his staff could at least, I want to find out what are we getting for it and what are we losing for it so we can make that value decision.
Okay. Just a little bit of background, just to frame for the committee the program and try to keep it very simple. In the 70s, Congress passed an act that basically told coastal states, we will give you power over federal government actions and permit decisions, and we will give you money if you do a coastal program. The power is in the form of what we call federal consistency, where before they take an action, if a state has a coastal program, they will come to the state and say, we're going to do something in your area. You have a coastal program. Before we do it, we will make sure our activities are consistent to the maximum extent they can be with your programs. It's an enormous empowerment for Alaska that is surrounded by outer continental shelf, leasing active in several areas, and has a lot of federal land along coastal Alaska as well. It also applies to federal permits. If there's projects going in and the feds are issuing a permit, they will also use our program as a base to assess if it not only meets federal law, but have our coastal program be the vehicle to have a dialogue about how to make those development activities fit within the Alaskan priorities for the area. The legislature in 77, well, starting in 75, were interested in the empowerments that this Act, that's federal act, gave us, and they debated for 2 years how we should do it. The feds gave us two options. You can either network your existing authorities in a coastal program, or you could just create a separate coastal permit. So the legislative debate that lasted from 75 through 77 examined different ways we might structure a coastal program to benefit by the federal empowerment. And this is on their dime. They basically gave us money to develop a program and continue to give the state of Alaska $2.6 million annually, which we distribute to coastal communities. We give some to resource agencies to assist those communities, and we keep some in the division to run the program. Just to put it in perspective, then, on two other occasions, the legislature took a hard look. Once the program was passed in 77, they took a hard look at it in 84, where they worked on the consistency, the body worked on the consistency process and made improvements to it there, and then worked on it again in 94, where other refinements were made. In each case, there has been a lot of debate and discussion about how to do it, and since we do have a network program, it is complex enough when you're trying to network resource regulation that you have to have that kind of dialogue. So I just want to say, to me, this committee meeting today is the real kickoff of having that dialogue that that accompanies every change to coastal management. The changes as proposed here are very significant, and I'll get right on the ones that are most significant. We did have one board. This is Gabrielle LaRoche, who is my program manager, and she's going to help me. We did have one board on the benefits, which maybe we can put up later. The one on the boundary, maybe we could just use the map, Gabrielle.
Can you refer to the where in the bill?
This would be provision, let me get my notes out here, section 2, which is to eliminate the zone of indirect influence. And on top of that, let's do the diagram, the schematic. This is our, in your packets, you have this diagram, and we didn't get it up on a big board, which might have been useful. If I knew the cameras were here, we would have put a little more energy into that one. But your blue sheet in your packet has this same schematic. And this is just to orient you to the zones that we're talking about. The zone of direct interaction is basically the intertidal zone. Oh, maybe you can flip it on the...
on one of the...
Yeah.
Clips.
The dark area is the zone of direct interaction, and that's basically tidal influence. And then the dark gray area, schematically represented here, both upland from the intertidal is coastal wetlands. It's basically flatter areas. Seaward is the continental shelf. That medium gray area is called the zone of indirect influence. Under this bill, what's being proposed is to simply limit our coastal boundaries to the dark gray and the light gray areas. The pink, and this is from 1977, this is our 1977 schematic that was used to originally approve the program, is the zone of indirect influence. And what it shows is, you know, higher elevation areas that can, you know, feed, have coastal influence by the force of gravity, basically. And what the proposal is to make sure that any coastal district that has a coastal plan includes no areas that are drawn from that pink upland zone. If you look at the map, we actually tried to take a look at what that section of the bill means. The green areas show what is the coastal boundary of Alaska. These were made, I might call your attention, behind the pink sheet you have a couple excerpts of other maps. These are from the 1977 copy. And we have very crude maps that lack detail, so much so they don't even have township and range in them. What we've done is tried to collect the data best we can get it based on these maps and put it to show you what it means for Alaska. And essentially you can see that several districts, when they did their local coastal district plan, they built in parameters that were sensitive largely to fisheries issues and expanded their boundaries by going through a local review process, a review process of the Coastal Policy Council, sent it on to the federal government with proper justification, and changed the boundaries to include what are the red areas there. These are only sample districts. We don't have enough data that separates the dark and the light gray from the white. We don't have anything digitized that shows that. But we tried to pull the data out of some plans and gave it to a cartographer in town and said, do what you can to help us try to distinguish between a line that doesn't exist in anybody's GIS system. And this gives you a feel for the kinds of changes that would be made by the amendment. Our problem with this issue is not that if the coastal boundary is too big, we should make it smaller. Our problem is that in the attempt to draw on some convenient mapping, we go back to 1977, and the bill is saying, change this back to the line that was drawn in 1977. And our estimates on what it would take to amend a local coastal plan take it through the Coastal Policy Council, get the appropriate mapping so that we can have today's technology and be able to produce better documents than the one I'm showing you here, and bring it to the federal government. To get those changes made means we're going to spend over $1 million to do that. And my fundamental concern with getting that job done is the way this bill is written, we're investing $1 million in, as it shows here on the bullets, we're forced to reduce it, but it outweighs the benefits. We would be investing $1 million in obsolete maps from 1977. We think our data set has improved, and we think the technology has improved. We're going to have to spend money to do mapping, and this locks us into a model and a... I have the entire set, actually. We dug it out of our library. We have a whole map. It locks us into some old data, and I just think if you're going to spend $1 million on the program, that's not a good place to spend it. 11 districts will have to do it. It will cost local governments time and money to do it. State resource agencies will have to weigh in to come up with justification for making those boundary changes.
Excuse me, Diane, on that point, who would be required to rewrite those plans?
It would begin at the local government level. 11 local governments would launch a system for amending their plans and go through the process at the local level. And then it would move on through the state and federal level. The bill calls for this to be done for the 11 districts in 6 months. Part of the $1 million cost is to do this kind of mapping and work on a very accelerated level, so we do anticipate having to hire some temps to try to rush through a mapping and then a public review and an approval process to meet that deadline. It's very, very tight, I would say bordering unrealistic. We've pulled off a few things, but that would be pushing it. Generally, the cost, we just don't think the cost for doing this, we don't see what the benefit is. You'll notice the next bullet says the number of consistency reviews may not decrease. And the reason for that is when these boundary changes were made and accepted at the federal level, there was an enormous amount of justification going with it. Much of that justification was tied to fisheries, and Alaska went back to D.C. and argued for protection and at least acknowledgement of salmon resources and their effects on the coastal economy and the coastal resources to argue for these boundary changes, and it was a difficult sell for the same reason. These are fairly extensive boundaries. We are now in a position to go back and argue against our arguments of the importance of these because the federal law says when we do a boundary, we have to be sure that we include areas of significant coastal resources. Having made these arguments, even if we shrunk the boundary back, if somebody wanted to have a project that was in one of these areas reviewed, they would simply rely on their original arguments of its value and say, because of the impacts we anticipate, the arguments made to change the boundaries, we want to review the project for consistency anyway. So they might capture the review. It would have very little effect on the number of project reviews. So on this point, it's not to say, as a policy matter, the legislature might not have a discussion about boundary changes or boundary size or how we might better focus our program. It's that this bill gets us investing in some old information, and I honestly don't see that the benefit either administratively going through the steps to do it or the benefit on the ground for making the change. I don't see where it is. So we're opposed having to go through that exercise.
I think this is probably an extremely important element of the proposal, and I would suggest, Representative, would you like to perhaps just speak for a moment here? I am going to get to everybody on the network here just as soon as I can, but I think it's important for you as well, and I hope you're listening in. to kind of hear this give and take debate here, so that when you testify, you'll know what bill you're testifying on, and you will hear both sides, hopefully both sides of some of these arguments. Representative, if you could, Representative Terrio, if you could tell us on that issue, on reducing the zone of indirect, how that, you know, maybe some response, please, if you could, sir.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it sounds like what we're hearing from the agency is they don't have good maps now. The level of detail, perhaps the time expenditure, hasn't been put into their existing maps. The impact is only to 11 districts. I guess I question, we haven't seen any justification for a $1 million figure. If a lot of the figure is derived from a compressed timeline, that would be a simple amendment that could be made by this committee with regards to stretching out the timeline, perhaps suggesting that they go on a project-by-project basis and work through it. The 6 months is certainly not set in stone. At this time, we have instances where coastal councils reach even outside of that their existing zone, and the CF does not curtail that ability. It just says that their starting point is a smaller, more defined zone along the true coast of Alaska.
Questions of the committee? Representative Dyson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Terrio, is it your view that having a smaller area of jurisdiction will produce a cost savings in the agency and a less restrictive environment for Alaska citizens and enterprises to go forward with their plans and lives?
Well, with regards to individual permittees, certainly if they fall outside of the more restricted zone, they would not have to go through the CZM necessarily. They still have to, though, if they're proposing something that requires state permits. If it's a mining project, that would be coordinated by DNR. So there's a potential there for one less part of state government interacting on the individual permit. There was an example written up in the Fairbanks paper a couple weeks ago where the district had reached outside its boundaries, and that particular case was fought through the state system right up to the state Supreme Court. I think that particular instance probably would have been curtailed. It's sort of hard to quantify an exact dollar impact one way or another.
And if I may continue, Mr. Chairman.
Dyson.
Are you postulating here that the passage of this bill will, after the transition time here and the $1 million or less for the transition, is it your position that the operating expenses of the agency will be less?
Potentially, but again, it's very hard to quantify. I think Diane indicated that actually within a more restrictive zone, they question whether it really would impact many permits at all, which leads me to believe that most of the permits are not in the far reaches at this time. So I don't know exactly how you can quantify potential savings or the actual cost, to tell you the truth.
Excuse me, go ahead, please.
Thank you. If you don't see that it's going to save operating money in the long term, and it's not presently impeding enterprise and citizen activity, why are you doing this?
I think we have instances where the coastal zone reaches hundreds of miles into the interior part of Alaska. I don't know that's what the original federal program intended, and I think we should make a policy call of what we believe the coastal zone of Alaska is which part of the state of Alaska should be swept in under this program.
So the we have a an agency going beyond their chartered purpose, and this your efforts here is to get them back on the reservation.
Yes.
Ann, could you maybe just speak briefly on some of that discussion? Mm-hmm. Is the agency, or are these permitting processes reaching well inland beyond what was originally intended in the Coastal Zone Management Act, do you think? You see that?
I see the question, and Alaska is a large state. If you look at the nature of the maps and the nature of the reaches that you can somewhat depict from these renderings here, they have a strong, in most cases, a very strong link to anadromous fish streams. So while they are inland, the reason that we were able to prevail with the federal government in establishing that they had some significant link to the coast was a fisheries link. And that is largely the argument that has been made throughout. Another point I might make just while I have the floor for a minute, please, because Representative Terrio made an excellent point. It looks like we have bad maps. That is exactly the point I'm making. The only maps we have that distinguish the zones that we see here in pink are 1977 maps, and they are bad maps. I would be happy to even pass this around if somebody wants to look at a map with no township and range. There's no anchor point. Maybe if you even want to just breeze through it as we talk. Becomes a very shaky foundation for mapping. But when these maps were done, they were intended to be refined when local coastal districts did do their coastal programs. And the first step is to do a resource inventory. Right now, 13 of the districts are in some stage of having a GIS system running. And through federal dollars, we've been able to actually put some money into these communities to get them up to speed. I think the Kenai Peninsula Borough has one of the best, well, I toured their system, so I'm familiar with that. Very sophisticated mapping. The thing is, when they did their mapping, nobody entered this zone information, so the line we don't have good data on is the very line that this bill is trying to get us back to. So it will require a lot of original mapping now going back to these old maps, and that gets back to my point. I don't see, if we have a point about we should change our policy on how we're going to define coastal influence in Alaska, my problem with the bill is it's tying us back to go through an exercise that I think doesn't match. We're going to have to do some serious mapping anyway, and to be tying us back to these old maps is putting a lot of money into some obsolete data.
You read the legislation as tying us into the old maps.
Right. The intent, as I understand it, and I think we're very clear on the intent, is the representative would like to see a smaller area of influence called coastal for Alaska. And as a policy matter and as an issue discussion, you know, boundaries certainly could be discussed. But it's the solution, the attempt at the solution to make it simple is tie it into something that's already on the books. But it's on the books from 20 years ago. So what we have is the intent to reduce the coastal boundary, but do it in such a way that it locks us into these old delineations, and we don't have good maps on these zones. So we will have to spend a lot of money going through the exercise. On the timing issue, part of the $1.1 million projected for this bill, I think we're in that neighborhood, is to bring on temps to meet the timing deadline. But even if we extend the deadline, there is nothing we can do to alter the process we'll have to go through. I do have a letter. It was in your packet last last week. I don't know if you have it, but it's from the our federal funding agency, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration. And they say here, just if I might just read the appropriate paragraph, the existing boundary was set as part of district program development and represents extensive issue, resource analysis, public involvement, and negotiation between this office and the state and the coastal districts. In many cases, the boundary was the most difficult issue to resolve during district program development. Nonetheless, working together, we were able to successfully, establishing a boundary that met state and local needs as well as the CZMA requirements, that would be the federal requirements. Any changes to the agreed-upon district boundaries should be accomplished through a similar process of analysis, public involvement, and negotiation. In any case, at a minimum, a state's coastal boundary must encompass all the areas necessary to control uses which have a direct and significant impact on coastal waters. And then in the back it says, substantive changes to boundaries and authorities are specifically identified as two of the more significant types of program changes that would be subject to the amendment process described at 15 CFR 923-81 through 83. So even if we extend the timeline to do the job, which would mean we wouldn't have to hire a bunch of temps to assist districts in getting through this process, there's nothing we can do to avoid going through the process, and that will still be costly.
Commissioner Terrio, do you have any comments on that?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would have to evaluate what dollar amount is being spent right now on the mapping, the further refinement of the map, and see how that expenditure couldn't possibly be an offset to the $1.1 million dollar, and I don't have that information at this time, and has not been supplied.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Jewell.
Mr. Chairman, Diane, with regards to the Anadromous Rivers and the far-reaching, mm-hmm. what is the importance of the Anadromous Rivers coming under this coastal zone as it is now?
The effect that...
And then the effect of the proposed change of that?
Yep. The effect that it has, if these expanded boundaries that capture then these upriver areas, that's what you're talking about, mm-hmm. has the effect of if project proposals occur in those areas, they are reviewed in a holistic way. Representative Terrio did mention in his opening remarks one of the benefits of coastal management was that we did bring all the parties together, all the players together, and we did do a synchronized review on a project basis. So if you have a project that's occurring in these areas, one, it brings all the expertise together sort of in the same time and place, reviewing the project in a collective fashion instead of a linear fashion. And the second thing that happens is a coastal district would have in its program enforceable policies that would address issues it would have about significant interests in those areas, and they would be a player at the table. So when that project went in, basically the local government would have a voice saying, well, here everybody is reviewing the project. Their issues would get put on the table, and they would have some standing in shaping how that project was laid into the landscape in those areas. So that's the benefit. If they're not there, they would probably argue effect anyway and argue for us to provide that same service of bringing the parties together and applying their program. If they weren't able to prevail, the project would be pursued in a less holistic fashion, and their standing would be.
I'm going to, out of deference to the people that have come down, for the second time, I'm going to move rather rapidly to that. But before I do, I want to just ask you, Diane, if you see any potential threatened loss of the federal coastal zone money that is currently received by the various communities in the state by this change in statutes.
We're looking at one of four changes is what we're discussing one right now. I think the threat on. If there was a threat, the federal rules require that our boundary include the significant resources or areas where there may be some significant ability to affect the coastal areas. Since we prevailed in making that argument, informing these boundaries, it might be tough to say we still have a coastal program as we go in and argue the reverse. We don't need these. They're not significant. They're obviously going to say, oh, I thought...
Your answer is...
Yes.
It's threatened. We have to deal with it.
All right. Thank you very much. Now I'm going to execute a chairman's prerogative, and I am going to start out. I'm going to take Arne Erickson at Naknek, Bristol Bay Borough. And Arne, I understand you're off net, and we'd take your testimony now. If you could, sir, try to keep it... very short, and as it directly applies to what you can testify to, please. Mr. Erickson, are you still on board? Gail Alstrom and St. Mary's?
Yes, I'm here.
Gail, could you give us your testimony, please? And I'm assuming at any rate you've been able to hear the dialogue we've had going here?
Yes.
Could you give us your testimony, and I would appreciate it as brief as possible, please.
Okay. My name is Gail Alstrom. I'm the program director for the Scenario Lake Coastal Resource Program based here in St. Mary's, and we serve the residents of the Yukon-Kuskokwim service area. Our program works within the framework of the Alaska Coastal Management Program to manage our coastal resources so we can continue to support a diversity of interests, livelihoods, and natural systems. Our goal is to achieve a balance between economic growth and resource protection. Working with the villages of our region, our program has managed to develop a coastal management plan specific to our area. Tailored to our local resources and issues, our plan has been reviewed extensively by the public, revised to address public concerns, and finally forwarded to the state and federal government for approval. Ensuring a balance of local, state, and national interests, this process works to give every entity involved a fair voice in how our resources will and should be managed. Each district plan is used by all three levels of government in decision-making about development projects. Permit applications for projects that would affect natural resources in our coastal zone are viewed for consistency with our plan. At the local level, coastal management gives local people better understanding in the state and federal decision-making processes. As this program is currently set up, both the coastal management planning process and the consistency review process encourage early and continuous consultation with local communities, government agencies, and the public to prevent or settle conflict. Several modifications proposed in Work Draft E would seriously harm the effectiveness of our coastal district and that of Alaska's 34 other districts along Alaska's coastline. Work Draft E, among other things, reduces local influence in state and federal land management decisions in Alaska's coastal zone, a limitation that we, as representatives for our coastal communities, find unacceptable and therefore strongly oppose. Specifically, Scenario Lake is concerned about two provisions in Work Draft E that seriously impact our current authorities and public involvement process. First, Section 5, which is intended to clarify that Alaska Coastal Management Program does not expand any agency's authority beyond that agency's statutory authority, makes it unclear whether the powers granted by the ACMP to municipalities and CRSAs will be unchanged. Currently, ACMP statutes themselves give the Scenario Lake CRSA the power to participate in consistency reviews and to raise concerns related to coastal uses, activities, and habitats. If this provision has any effect, it would be to delete an important authority that ACMP grants to CRSAs, and that is the authority to raise concerns related to coastal uses, activities, and habitats during the consistency review, and to have these concerns resolved through stipulations on state or federal permits. Coastal resource service areas like Scenario Lake do not have independent planning and zoning powers to fall back on, like municipalities do through Title 29. Nalyoate CRSA cannot grant its own permit. If as a result of this provision of work draft E, Nalyoate and other CRSAs could no longer suggest stipulations to be carried on state and federal permits, the value of the ACMP to our CRSA is then essentially lost. Without the authority to run our program, we have no real purpose for existence. This is one reason why we are in opposition of this bill. Our second matter of concern relates to Section 6 of Work Draft E, and this eliminates the process of petitioning for consistency determination appeals. This petition process currently allows the Snowy-Lake CRSA to bring consistency determination appeals directly to the Alaska Coastal Policy Council. Although this process is not routinely utilized by us, it does offer us the opportunity, when necessary, to have our concerns considered fairly by the council. The council is comprised of 9 elected officials from our coastal communities and 7 members of the governor's cabinet. Without the petition process, our coastal district and its citizens will not have this avenue for involvement. For a program that consistently works to involve local communities and focus on local resources and issues, this limitation would effectively undermine the whole integrity and usefulness of the program. In closing, our district thanks you for the opportunity to testify today, and we look forward to your support in opposition of House Bill 28, Work Draft E.
Thank you, Ms. Alstrom. Chuck Dignan of Unalakleet. Mr. Dignan, if you could try to be hopefully within a minute or two, so we can try to get as many testimonials as we can. Please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before your committee. We are in opposition to House Bill 28 and the committee substitute. And primarily, most of the issues have been addressed by Gail Alstrom. There are many rivers in our area that carry salmon and other anadromous fish, and those are important resource, coastal resource, and the